Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and good evening, radio audience. Welcome to the fourth in this year's series, Work and Progress in the Social Studies. And tonight, our speaker is Professor Peter Mayo, professor in the Department of Education Studies, University of Malta. For any audience of these seminars, Peter needs no introduction, but for our radio listeners, we'll say a few words about Peter. He is an internationally widely published author, and his recent books include The Politics of Indignation, published by Zero Books in 2012, and that's the book about which he's going to speak tonight. He also published in 2012 and this year two other books. One is called Learning with Adults, co-authored with Leona English in a series by Sense. And the third book is Echoes from Frera for a Critically Engaged Pedagogy, and that is published by Bloomsbury this year. So without further ado, I welcome Peter Mayo to speak to the title, The Politics of Indignation.
Okay, thanks for coming. I know you all, you know, you're all very busy, and it's a pleasure to present this book to you, the contents of it. And I'd like to say something about the publishers first. This book has been produced by Zero Books. They're a new publishing house, relatively new. I think they've only been in existence for 3 years. I just got to know about them by mere chance. And the whole idea was that I wanted to put all my opinion eds and news analysis, which I used to write, I wrote very recently, actually, over a span of about 2 years, in outlets like Truth Out, primarily, and Counterpunch. Mainly those are the ones. Then I've got an odd, book review, which I felt would fit the collection, and an article which I once published in The Times and then appeared on Indie Media afterwards about the Millennium Development Goals. The idea was, I said, they all have a common theme. Now, that common theme is neoliberalism. Might be very hard to see that at first, but I lay it out in the introduction. Neoliberalism and also the sense of indignation, which exists in various parts of the world. Now, like most of you, I know most of you are social activists and work in the social field, we have been gripped by this manifestation of indignation. I think indignation has always been there, but more than ever, it has been beamed out globally, where all the streets and squares have become global squares and global streets. And I think it was quite a phenomenon to see what was happening in the Arab world, sometimes not with the kind of conclusions that one would have hoped for. And, one becomes many ones. We all have different perspectives. And also, what was happening in Europe. And I have to say that myself with Carmel, we also were involved. For example, we were asked by the Green Party and its academy in Vienna to help out theoretically with some of the discussions which were going on by activists who participated in the protests against the neoliberal reforms of the university. Now, when I wrote these articles, obviously there were some topics which were very much close to my heart, and I just felt I should write about these. Other topics were also conditioned by the timing. They had a news hook. But the news hook, as the editor of Truth Out puts it, that's why I learned it from her, Leslie Thatcher, the news hook would be, for example, you think of an anniversary of something which took place. So it could be something which took place 40 years ago, but this is an anniversary. Now, the topics that I cover in this book, but you can see there's a connection between neoliberalism. The first one actually got me working is called Neoliberalism and the State. Now, what got me, I'll just go over the themes because I don't have the PowerPoint. This is not lit, because otherwise it would have been there, and it will help you in the Q&A, because I'm going to only focus on two. But in the question and answer period, you may want to ask me about how I developed this, how does this fit into the whole thing. The first one is about neoliberalism and the state. And I have to say, I did a lot of work over the last 2 years over the state, about the state has not gone away. the form that the state has taken during this period, despite the mantra that we get, this popular mantra that the state has now been diminished. I think it's not on your life, okay? And that was actually a response to the kind of discussion we had when I last gave a paper in the seminar, when people saying the state is passé, all this thing of thinking about the nation state is passé, and I instead of saying, you know, complete BS, I said, I got back to work and I wanted to work about the state, so I went back to reread all the stuff we used to read in sociology about the state, see what's relevant, and try to make some sense out of it. So a couple of papers and a chapter of an academic nature appeared, and also a more journalistic, more user-friendly article, which I wrote here. I would say this is more simple, hopefully not simplistic. And that's the first chapter. Then I move into the issue of, it was close to September, and as you know, September, in terms of political history, is a terrible month. Big massacres took place in September. Okay, the September, the Black September itself. September 11th in Chile, September 12th, just one day, in Turkey, September 11th, the third one, in the United States. There might be some others in between. Okay, so that's not the first September 11th that we've heard of. And I call this using a title from, you know, I try to mix also my interests from sports and also in terms of rock and blues. A famous song by Cream, the famous rock band Cream, Born Under a Bad Sign. Because I want to show the violent origins of neoliberalism. And this is also in relation to my previous chapter on the state, because the state I also bring in the whole issue of neoliberalism. What is the neoliberal state today? Thanks. And then the promise of Cuba as an alternative to what happened in Chile, the promise of Cuba and its post-colonial principles. Now, I'm not talking about its implementation. That is open to discussion, and I would have to do field work in Cuba itself. But I was always struck by some of the principles which were there. And then also I went back to Nicaragua, because Nicaragua, it was the 30th anniversary, well, I wrote this, of the Nicaraguan literacy campaign. Okay, and I don't think it should have been forgotten. But this is all in contrast to the Chile experience. Then I move into an experience I had in Turkey with Carmen. It was May Day in Turkey. They were celebrating May Day for the third time without any restrictions as to who can participate and who can't. For 7 years, the May Day celebrations were banned in Turkey because some gunfire took place and people were left dead. So I mused on the whole idea of worker solidarity and what does it mean today? What does it mean today in terms of neoliberal globalization? And what does the working class? I think it's very relevant to Malta right now. Okay, well, is there a working class? What form does the working class take today? Is it true we have a strong middle class, or do we have a new working class, a bifurcated one? Anyway, I go into those issues. And then from there, I move into what was happening in Rome with the blue, black, what they call it, those tactics, those black, yeah, that one, yeah. I also move into that, and I start moving now towards movements in Europe. And then I talk about, I call it the politics of indignation as Rome burns. And there's a lot of burning in this, by the way. Yeah, I mean, you can see my Christian background. Yeah, Carthage burns, Rome burns. And then university burns. And this is one of the things I will be presenting today. University burns. It's about a view from Europe. The connection with neoliberalism is very strong, the reforms which are taking place at the university. This connects with my oration at the graduation, by the way. It was the basis for my oration, which was in Maltese that day. And then I move out of Europe. I talk about migration coming into Southern Europe. This is something I've been working on for a long time. Okay, this is actually a reworking of an old paper I wrote. It's interesting because this paper got me into looking at Islam, not in a very professional way, of course, but also the legacies of Islam in what is now called Western civilization, which is really, you know, like it's nothing essentialist about it. It, you know, it derives from many other things. And then that's the one on migration. That brings me into Islam. And then based on an extended review I did of a book, facets and representations of Muslim youth. This was originally an extended review of a book about Muslim youth. But I learned a lot from it, and it's also it challenges some of the westernized constructions and conceptions of Muslim youth. It shows its variegated nature. It starts off actually with a blues band in Turkey. It's something I experienced with Carmel and friends of mine. I don't know, there was somebody, Michael Greck was with us, I think. And from there, it takes off into some of the themes broached in this book. And then I talk about a paper I co-wrote with Linda Herrera, which was originally published in Holy Land Studies. And this is based on a project in which we are involved. I personally am involved also with Palestinian universities. I'm involved in a project, a Tempus project. But also, I was very much interested, and Linda is also an expert on Middle Eastern studies. I mean, she speaks Arabic. She is married to a Lebanese. She worked a lot in newspapers dealing with Islamic culture, and not just Arabic culture, but also Islamic culture. And now she's a professor at Illinois University. We wrote this together. It was actually based on our proposal for this project for the Mediterranean Research Center, which there is connected with the European University in Fiesole. And this was published in Holy Land Studies, but it fit this book. And then, of course, something I wrote about education and the MDGs, which takes us a lot into I hate to use the word third world, quote unquote third world, okay? And finally, as an educator, I wrote a piece based on something I had written in the Encyclopedia of Modern Political Thought, which is coming out. It's called A Critical Approach to Education, which is actually taking stock of all this and how do I see critical education developing. Now, it would be impossible at this stage, in this 1 hour, or less now, that I actually tackle every topic, but then I will leave that for you for the questions to ask about it. Some of you have read the book, I know you have read it. Some of you even have reviewed it or are reviewing it. As for those, I hope I can whet your appetite to read it. So I want to focus on two chapters. And I was thinking hard yesterday, actually, which chapters should I focus on? So yesterday I was thinking of, Paul gave me the advice that you can't cover everything, of course. I mean, I tell my students not to be all over the place. So I'd like to actually, I chose two to discuss. The first one I thought, as I told you earlier on, we're in 2013. 1973, 2013, there's a lot of maths there. That's what, 40 years? How much is that? Huh? Do I get through the maths audition? Okay, because I'm not all that good at maths. But anyway, so we're talking about 40 years. This September 11th is the 40th anniversary of one of the bloodiest birth pangs of neoliberalism, which is the coup d'etat in Chile. And I didn't go there, but we remember it. People of my age remember it. I'm even Giuseppe. I'm 57, going on to 58. I'll never forget. I was at sixth form, and I remember the pages. Yeah, right. Good. Good for you. Good for you. These are much younger, though. I remember you used to have all these news booming out, very biased, in the Times front page, Reuters. The first thing I remember having read is that because his experiment, Allende's, of socialism failed, it did not pay out. Anyway, how did I get interested in this? Well, this is something which captured my imagination. That one and the invasion of Cyprus, the situation in Cyprus, that was the following year. Those are things which remained etched in one's memory. Now, I was seeing these from afar, but then you meet people. You study abroad, you work abroad, you meet people who have actually lived through it. So Cyprus, I've been seven times there. I've got friends who actually had to move from one place to the other, but then I've met Turkish people, give you a different side to the story, etc., etc. Chile, well, I've mixed with people from Chile. Ramon, I never told you this, because he's very keen on Chile. Chile, I mixed when I was in Canada, neighbors, friends, etc. So most of them were in exile. They didn't go back. Pinochet was still there. This was I'm talking about 1986, 88. So, you'd mix with these people, you discuss your perceptions from Malta, then they give you another side to the story, etc. So all this was, and I kept reading about this stuff. So I wrote this article. And the first thing is I play on the date. Now, I'm not suggesting anything. I'm not suggesting anything sinister about the date, you know? I mean, we live in conspiracy theories in a small country like Malta. I always found it very strange. September 11th, everybody talks about one September 11th. When they talk about 9/11, they talk about what happened in New York City and Washington. But in Latin America, they talk about la primera, el primero 11 septiembre, the first 11 September, and which is precisely what happened in Chile. And what I try to do in this article, which was published in Truth Out, no, in Counterpunch, actually, Counterpunch. I remember it was Jeffrey St. Clair who published it immediately. I try to make a link, you know, the neoliberal connection between the two. The neoliberal connection between the two. The one everybody talks about, and Counterpunch is a United States-based, but very left-wing, actually very, I would say, critical progressive outlet, which you will find online. And I try to make that connection between September 11th, the one that everybody talks about, and the one which not very few people, except those in Latin America, which cannot be few, being in Latin America, talk about. The connection between the two. So one of them, you have a reaction against neoliberalism. I'm not condoning it, but, you know, we start comparing. You know, I mean, I'm not the only one who said this. Chomsky has said this, and Ariel Dorfman is the other guy. He wrote about it in The Nation, etc., and then the book came out. They always talk about it. If you count the amount of people who were killed in Chile under Pinochet, immediately, not later I'm talking about, I'm not even counting those, immediately after the coup d'etat in Chile, and compare how many people died. I'm not condoning what happened. They're still human beings. It could be one or two people who died after all. There's no comparison in terms of numbers. Now, okay, when you talk about human lives, numbers are not all that great, but it still is. So I try to make that kind of connection between the two. But the major connection is neoliberalism. Here we have a reaction against it, of course, albeit you can interpret that reaction the way you like. It could be a fundamentalist, militant Muslim reaction to neoliberalism. But the first one was actually one of the first, not to say the first, all right? You can't be absolute. Trial runs of neoliberalism. It was not a global system. Then it happened under Thatcherism. Thatcher came into power in 1979 in England, and Reagan, and Reaganomics, and Thatcherism. They turned that into a global system. But there what you had was the trial run of a system which was very much inspired by the economics of Milton Friedman and Haberge and other people. And there was a plan in Chile to implement that program by people who were known as the Chicago Boys. I'm sure some of you already know this, the Chicago Boys, because they studied with Milton Friedman in Chicago. Now, whether it was an organized course or they were sent there to have a special program, like what the London School of Economics tried to do with people manning the civil service, personing, I should say, the civil service in Libya, there was an attempt at that. Okay, whether it was a course tailor-made, I don't know. But there was this plan to create the, you know, what today we call neoliberalism, this kind of free market economy, etc. But the people elected Allende. They elected Allende, and Allende was opposite in the sense that not only was he socialist, but he was he was actually nationalizing precisely what did not fall, it would not go according to the script. It was not Friedman's script. He was actually nationalizing things, and we all know what happens. And of course, the truth comes out gradually. Massacres, what it meant to the left. But what struck me about is to commemorate in that particular article is how much bloodshed was shed, how much blood was shed for, how much blood was shed for this process we call neoliberalism, which has been governing a lot of the experiences I deal with throughout the book to take place. And of course, I try to remember what I've said in that article, but it's basically, you know, certain places have a particular name. They do instill terror in people's mind. Just to mention, you know, we hear the surname Grimaldi a lot in Europe. a certain Villa Grimaldi was a center for torture. We had the case of anybody who's supposed to be leftist, even accused of being leftist. All you have to be is a student, you know, waxing left-wing theories. You end up in the major stadium, which they had there, and you'll be whisked off to someplace. If you're lucky, you survive. If not, you disappear. This was a time in Latin American history where you had one stage after the other. Videla, for example, in Argentina afterwards. So, that's from the World Social Forum in Kenya, that picture. So, I do have this here. Okay, that's the book. These are the contents here. The first part. Good. So, those are some of the themes. I will change this. I use your Inter Milan colors, by the way. And I'll change that. So, and then, just to move into the second chapter, what is the connecting point? Well, the connecting point is that those struggles for which so many people paid with their life in Chile were replicated, by the way. I don't deal with this in the book, but I deal with it in a separate article I wrote recently. That Soul's process was replicated in 1980 in Turkey. Well, you have a replica, literally a replica, of what happened in Latin America, particularly Chile and a bit of Argentina. Because, again, in Turkey, I don't know how many of you have ever been to Istanbul and other places, you know, like, you've got so many movements, from Kemalists to the Gulen movement, they call that. There are many movements, but there's also a very strong left. And in Turkey, round about 1980, a similar situation happens, where the army, which is a secular army, it is the defender of secularism. In a way, it is supposedly, it bears the legacy of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. So it is an image of secularism, but it's also on the pay of the United States. It is, very much so. In fact, one of the reasons why you had the Cuban Missile Crisis in the early 60s was because Russia placed missiles overlooking Florida, overlooking the United States, in retaliation for the America placing missiles in Turkey overlooking the Soviet Union. And it was a reaction. But the army is on the one hand very secular, but it's very pro-United States. It's not very different from its function, was not very different from what was happening in Latin America at the time. And you had the same pattern. It was, if you ask any person from Turkey, he will tell you, he or she will tell you, all right, that this was a step to generate neoliberalism in Turkey in a very brutal way. And was very similar, I don't think, not maybe in numbers, I'm not sure, but certainly was similar to what happened in Chile, where you had a coup d'etat by the military to implement programs which had already been introduced through parliament by somebody, a prime minister who used to work for the World Bank before. In my article, you find it on, it was published in Truth Out with two colleagues of mine, Antonia Dardier and Hudson. You'll find it on Truth Out. It was published around in September, because this was on 12th September. I mean, we talk about a day difference, right? 12th September, 1980. And a similar coup d'etat, and everybody tells you this is how neoliberalism had its birth pangs in, very painful birth pangs, in Turkey. Now, what happened there, it was not that you had a government like Allende's government, who was nationalizing. There was already a government which was already implementing, but this was like of the acceleration of it, sort of to drive it home. And people disappeared. Lots of people on the left were either held in custody, beaten up, disappeared, killed, literally, including editors of publishing houses. And there are publishing houses which are quite left-wing in Turkey. It's a place I know quite well. I know some of the cities. I've been there about seven times now in total, between Ankara and Istanbul. Actually, I'm going there my seventh time, rather than being there. And I've worked with students there, so they all tell me their stories, etc. Suffice to mention, a replica of Argentina, in one of the squares of Turkey, every Saturday, it's called Galatasaray Square. That's where the famous football team comes from. because there's a high school called Galatasaray High School, and the football team was the high school team, that team which is now in the Champions League quarterfinals. They were from there, actually, it was the high school team. That square, every Saturday, houses a protest by mothers of people who were disappeared. A replica of the Videla years in Argentina. So you have the same pattern there. And that maybe we don't hear much about that, about the Turkish situation. We hear more about Chile and Argentina and not Turkey, certainly in our part of the world, not in other parts of the world. So what I've tried to highlight by writing those articles were, first of all, the moment, September. Okay, this one will be more poignant, it's the 40th year of Chile. I'm making this connection. But then the connection with, of course, the reaction that you get from like we had in New York in 2001. And there's a common thread, which is neoliberalism there. I don't think I can reduce everything to one thing, but it's there. The other thing is, the other article I would like to highlight, because we're doing this at a university, I was assuming some of the people here would be academics, but many or others would be students, as many are, is also the university in a neoliberal context. And where can I see a connection with the September 11th? Well, certainly with Chile, because the legacies of Pinochet are still there. They are still there in the scars of people who have lost their loved ones. They are there in the scars of people who have survived torture. Some people have survived torture, okay? By DINA, the Secret Service. But they're also there in the policies which, no matter how so-called democratic subsequent governments were, have not changed. Well, the classic one, which also captured the imagination of some of our students' reps here, thank God, you know, finally, was the student protests, not last summer, the one before. I believe it was the summer before. The student protests in Chile, and I mentioned that in the book, because it happened, you know, this was after I had published the article. And what are they protesting against? They're protesting against the legacies of Pinochet in education, where you have to pay for any kind of formal educational experience, including attending state schools, let alone universities. And students are running into huge debts because you had precisely the trial run of neoliberal politics, and that neoliberal politics also touched the educational system and the universities. There's no such thing as a free lunch. Can you imagine? We are used to having free state-provided education here in Malta. Now, of course, one can argue, what kind of choice do we have? You know, if you don't go to a private school, you might be fobbed off by a system which is underfunded, but I don't think it's all that bad. It's not that bad. Some of our schools are still functioning properly and could be also, some of them are models, others aren't. I mean, I can talk from experience going out to see students as a tutor during teaching practice. But in Chile, you have to pay even to attend a government-funded school, a government school, a state school. And this is still going on today. It's even worse with universities, where the fees have become so hectic that people run into huge debts. Students have been protesting. An interesting thing is, it was not just a student protest, but it's a protest which combines different sectors of Chilean society together. They are bringing on board, they have brought on board, the major workers' union. The major workers' union. Now I'm getting old, it's in the book, I've got the actual details. So this is where protests can become effective. It's taken long, but this is where it can be, when it doesn't remain just an isolated case, but other organizations come into play because they see the importance of a free education, and they are insisting that education should be free, and this should be enshrined in the constitution, which it isn't, of Chile. Which brings me to the chapter on the university burns. Now, I wrote part of that chapter as an article. The acoustic is very interesting here. It gets louder when you come to the center. I wrote the first part of that article. I wrote that article basically before certain regulations took place in Greece. But I did interview, and I've got some of the voices there. Some people were very much involved as part of the Indignados movements. in Spain, in Greece, in Austria, through email, and Egypt. A former student of mine had participated at Tahrir Square, for instance, in the riots there. And this is, you find them in the book. Now, well, the university is, we're not there yet, but we're getting there, I think, if we're not careful enough. The way reforms have taken place across universities have changed the whole idea of the university. Now, I mean, hopefully the chapter is much more sophisticated than this. This is not the university as it was presented to us once. As I say, presented to us, doesn't mean it actually was. This whole idea of a community of scholars, the pursuit of knowledge for its own sake, that is also problematic in my view. Okay, that's based on the German Humboldtian tradition. And this comes from a tradition in Germany, which is very elitist, by the way. So I am all for a reform of the university. But I am all for a reform of the university which makes it more accessible and which reaches out into communities. That is why I supported the venture in the Cotonera, the opening of a center there. That's not the kind of reform we got. So a lot of the critique of the traditional elitist university, all right, and Maltese University in the 70s was, and 60s, even worse, was elitist, okay? I mean, Giuseppe can confirm this before. But what happened was, sometimes those arguments take a different trajectory. You know, what we saw taking place in Europe, and we've seen this also in the United States and et cetera, is, yes, they've changed the university, but I'd rather have the old university, you know, write an epitaph like Gramsci did to the classical school, to the old university, rather than celebrate the new university. At least there were certain issues there which should have been tackled, should have been much more accessible, you know, the importance given to the humanities, et cetera, which today are no longer there. And basically, what I'm arguing there is the things we live through every day, the excessive bureaucratization of the university, the university becoming another institution of neoliberalism. University of Malta, we can discuss that, okay? I think there are still vestiges of what I call a decent university. But in other places, England in particular under Cameron, the United States before, and many places of Europe, as I point out there, and I'll come to that, this is becoming streamlined into a very neoliberal place where students are no longer considered to be part of an academic community, but are consumers. You know, we already have it here. I have to provide, even though I'm discussing a philosophical topic, for example, an outcome. I have to put down an outcome, so that you can sue me if I don't follow those outcomes. Now, I'm teaching a course on Friday on Gramsci hegemonian society. Now, what kind of outcome did I put down? The big joke in our class is we will promise to produce full-time revolutionaries. One. The second one is going to be we are going to enable these brains for working for 20 years. Boom. And we go on and on. You know, it doesn't work that way. But it's all based on the whole idea of the student as consumer. It's all a consumption good. And this is a reflection of the kind of society, of people, that is promoted by a neoliberal kind of thinking, which is basically people are not seen as social actors. Of course, we killed those social actors. Those were the people who ended up in the Stadio de Chile, okay? Or they whisked away to the Villa Grimaldi and other places. Ramona will tell you all of them, right? Because she's got tremendous knowledge of what happened in Chile. But, you know, we don't want social actors. But we want consumers, producers, producers, consumers. You know, Marcuse is one-dimensional person or man. Arrhenius called it two-dimensional, but they're two interlinked. Consumers, producers. And you can see this through the policies and the discourse which is coming out with regard to university. Coming out from where? But for many places, in our case, the European Union. I carried out a study which lies some of the things I said in this study, which was an academic study. These are journalistic articles. This was academic. It was a paper I published in International Studies and Sociology of Education, where I looked at all the documents, practically most of the documents. I wrote this about in 2009, from before 2000, actually, up to 2009. And I can tell you there's been a deluge of communications coming out from the Commission in Brussels about the university. And all the documents promote things like entrepreneurialism, okay, but a particular kind of entrepreneurship they're talking about. We take these on board here uncritically, all right? The idea of the market, actually a structural connection between industry and university, etc., etc., etc. Okay, I don't have to this connects also with the view which is being promoted, not by educators in our Faculty of Education, hopefully, but promoted out there, where industrialists claim that they have a much better right to talk about education than educationists, because they can send it down the tubes, which is basically streamlining education to the needs of industry. I'm not saying there shouldn't be no connection with work. Of course there should be. But it's all about the economy is seen in monolithic terms. We have to fit the economy, rather than we could be agents of changing the economy. Not alone, of course, because education on its own doesn't change things. It can only make a contribution. So this is all there also in the discourse on education. So we have all this discourse which streamlines university education about, and it's all focused on ICT and employability, which, as most of our indignados friends all over Europe will point out, does not mean employment. You are employable, but it doesn't mean I'm going to employ you. So that, rather than saying that we have a crisis of capitalism which cannot generate jobs for various reasons outlined by a famous German political economist who is no longer fashionable, or maybe he's becoming fashionable again, okay? Rather than saying we have an economic crisis which cannot create jobs, what in actual language would be called, we have a jobs crisis, we are turning that into a skills crisis. You don't have the skills for this job. The truth is, if one looks at empirical research, which comes out of various places, France, Canada, Germany in particular, people are discovering that people are studying more. They are having these skills, but they still remain unemployed, or they live a level of precariousness. Now, one of the persons I interviewed, and I quote there, was a social movement activist. Carmen knows him, Philip. I shouldn't say the name, actually. It's supposed to be, according to the canons of research, remains. Yeah, this guy, was one of the leaders of a movement in Germany, in Vienna, who organized a big, big confrontation with the state and universities because of the neoliberal reforms. Now, what I find exciting there, and this took place not just in Vienna, but it took place into rather the whole area. It took place in the Czech Republic. It took place in Hungary, many other places. Students were revolting. They were revolting against, this is before the indignados. This is before the riots in Britain. This was before the student protests in Britain against the hike in prices introduced by Mr. Cameron and his sidekick Clegg in England. This was much before, where student movements got together in the former Austro-Hungarian Empire, if you like, and coordinated their efforts. And when there was a ministerial meeting for ministers of education from these countries in Vienna, the people in Hungary blocked the train carrying ministers over to Vienna. What was happening there? It was a protest against the neoliberal reforms. Now, what I'm trying to say is this. There must have been some enlightenment there among students to actually see through those reforms, because I don't see much of that enlightenment here in Malta. Some of those reforms, some of those buzzwords, those catchwords, those doxa, if you want to be more polite in academic circles, are taken on uncritically over here. How many times do we sit in meetings and we hear people who are involved in policy making, if not also academics, all right? Because let's put academics on a pedestal, mouthing the kind of cliches and the kind of discourse which in actual fact is what leads us to say, listen, is this what education is all about? You know, taking on board uncritically what I'm talking about here. Well, in Vienna, they organized huge protests. They blocked the universities. And what did they do? Now, I'm not saying this is going to be an effective process. I don't know. History will tell. They did what the indignados did afterwards. They started setting up tents creating alternative ways of doing education. So people teach each other. You know, there's always an expert on physics who could teach this to laypersons and vice versa, etc. This is something which eventually the Occupy movement did in America, the United States, and also in London, famous 10th City University, as part of the Occupy London move, London movement, an alternative university, an alternative university with a popular appeal, but popular, not populist. All right. So there is a lot of this going on. Where will it lead to? I don't know. You can be cynical and say, okay, this is like, you know, we've had this before. I'm not so sure. I think there's a groundswell. Now, what I do in the book, of course, I look at various situations, even the Arab world, etc., and see, you know, the nature of this groundswell. And what potential does this groundswell have? Well, certainly one of the things which emerges in these situations is creativity. It's amazing how the creativity of people comes out. They did the same thing in Greece as well. Okay, and I have, by the way, I forgot, I've got interviews with people from Greece. I probably mentioned that as well. And they do come up with new ideas of doing education. Now, it doesn't mean that we're going to create a university on these lines, but what it does is, it does actually provide insights, okay, as to what a different university could build on. It's not going to be exactly like that, but insights can come out. After all, it was protests like these which brought about certain changes. I don't know, in France, for example, the 68 movement, everybody can poo-hoo that, but university in France changed a lot as a result of the 68 movement. You know, it's not like Germany. The professor is not up there anymore. That sort of thing. Now, what I'm trying to say is, there's a groundswell. I'm not saying, you know, I've studied this groundswell completely. I've just looked at it journalistically. But it needs to have greater, more studies to see what new insights can emerge for a different way of doing things economically. I know there's a lot going on also in certain parts of Italy in terms of creazione sociale. I don't have the time to go into that. And also in terms of institutions, hallowed walls like the academy. How can the academy change? How can, the whole point is this. Is the university there to serve industry only, or is it also there to do something much more important, which is to contribute to the development of what Habermas would call a public sphere, to development of a democratic public sphere. So we're talking about democracy in the broadest sense of the term there. That brings out issues of access, it brings out issues of social difference, it brings out a variety of issues. The role of the university as something which contributes to the development and consolidation of a democratic public sphere. When these spheres or spaces are continuously shrinking, look around you. It's happened in the States, it happened in Canada, happens in Europe, happens everywhere, where public space is shrinking. I mean, you weren't with us. We were in Vittoriosa, listening to people from Vittoriosa, kids and youngsters, as to what they expect from our university. Not we tell them. I was invited by José Nkutayar to participate in the discussion. And the first thing they told us, the people from, this was Vittoriosa, is, and they haven't read Habermas, and they haven't read all this literature about, is, we have no public spaces. We have to pay for everything. We can't even play football. We've got to pay to go in. We can't even swim in a place called the Toba, which is well known amongst Vittoriosa people. They still have to pay. Everything is shrinking. So, you know, it's not just something which is happening out there, it's happening here. Capitalism is real. The universe of capital, somebody wrote. Okay, it's there. And how does the university respond to that? Okay, how does it respond to that legacy of that system which was steeped in bloodshed? Hence, I want to go back to my first paper to make the connection. What I'm trying to bring out is the nature of violence which runs throughout capitalism, throughout neoliberalism. It takes different forms. It could be naked violence, could be symbolic violence. And I stop there. Actually, this thing of violence is something I have to develop further. Maybe it's not that pronounced in the book, but anyway.
Thank you very much, Peter, for extremely clear, lucid overview of your book and what your own concerns are. Mm. And now I'm sure there are people who would like to ask you questions.
Sure.
Based upon the book. I just make a comment that the global system remains alive and well. In the latest issue of The Guardian Weekly, Tariq Ali gives a long memoir of Chavez and his many meetings with Chavez.
Mm-hmm.
And Chavez believed in Obama for just a few days. And then when he found out how the United States was involved in the coup in Honduras,
and Paraguay.
That nothing had changed, in fact.
Well, hope springs eternal. But there are others who have felt like Chavez as well.
Peter, thanks a lot. Very interesting discussion. And I must apologize that I have not yet read the book. But my comments would be slightly fragmentary, really. But anyway, you reminded me a lot, without going into the anecdotal side of the question, of our own recent history.
Mm.
But what interested me
Our own in Malta?
Yes, of course. Oh. What interested me a lot is, because although I said I'm much younger, I'm not that much younger,
I remember,
of course, September. And I even remember our own student demonstration protesting against the American invasion in Chile. Anyway, that's the anecdotal part of it. But another important thing is the Mintoffian legacy of education.
Oh.
I don't want to enter the particular partisan negative situation, but I know that his policy towards education in the 70s was maybe today, by hindsight, we can say slightly premature. But what you were saying about neoliberalism is precisely what Mintoff wanted to implement in the early 70s, quite early. The fascinating part of it is
having
a left-wing, radical social democrat, within the social democrat parameter, of course, trying to convince and persuade all, without success, including me myself, in the question that our degrees would be Gazzetta Talinchova, to quote,
yes, that's
right? Because we need, I am quoting again, this integral relationship between the university and industry.
Yes.
That was in the early 70s,
yes.
Something which today we're implementing in this neoliberal. So the link with Chile is also fascinating, because the early Social Democrat Party under Mintoff was completely aware and cautious that that might even happen in Malta. Now, whether this is true or not, it's not the question, but it was a very concrete fear appertaining to that particular government, that particular year. That's the first thing which I would love to hear your comment.
I have a lot of thoughts on that.
Yeah, I don't want to go in more detail, but the last thing which I would love to hear a comment from you, I think you were present, correct me if I'm wrong, at the university forum which you organized last month at Christopher Street.
I wasn't.
Oh, that's a pity. I'm sorry. In the sense that we had this fascinating professor, Doherty,
this
right?
This was the Faculty of Arts?
Yes.
I see, I wasn't invited to that one.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm not. But the question was the role of university, etc. Whereas in the first part, we had this public talk which concerned what you were stating now, the role of university, this employability, etc., etc. And the second part of the forum, unfortunately, came to the conclusion there is no problem, there is no crisis. Coming from the, particular.
Okay, all right.
Thanks a lot. I'm sorry I took so
long. No, it's okay. The first part I've been working on, because I did some research for a forum organized by the Labour Party organized by the university, sorry. Not the forum. I'm talking about revisiting Labour's history. And I actually researched the worker student scheme, because I was a product of it. I was under that system. Now, I always found that a bit, how should I put it? It's a bit contradictory. I know, how can I answer this? Without hogging it too much now, because other people have to get a chance. What I argued in that paper is that of course, I was critical, and at the same time, I could see some of the positive sides. I try to provide a very balanced view without being neutral. I say that. I wrote it from a socialist perspective. And I critiqued that project from a socialist perspective. So I bring out the big contradictions. Now, it would be impossible to summarize all that. Unfortunately, I don't want to do what our authors arrogantly always say, read my book, read the book. Not this book, the book, the labor history book. And it's also in the book on Mintoff, a smaller version in Maltese. I criticized the doing away with the humanities. I felt that it was not in keeping in sync with a socialist project. But I also argue that the humanities have to be much more accessible. But there were good things. I mean, one of the good things was it allowed any employee, in theory, I don't know how it worked out, to actually leave the job and join the scheme. They had that system. There were many good things. I mean, what Mintoff had in mind at the time was the policy of the Labour Party from 1971 was to bring the MCAST, the former Polytechnic, not the MCAST we have today, the former Polytechnic, because of certain areas it was covering, which were not deemed to be of university level here, and they were considered to be modern professions. The kind of industrial revolution that Mintoff tried to introduce from mercantile capitalism to a much more industrial capitalism fueled by local and foreign capital. All right? And therefore, university was not producing that. Even Dahrendorf himself, everybody criticizes Dahrendorf, says what Dahrendorf said to knock the reforms. Dahrendorf was very critical of the university before. He said it was just an appendage to the professions. So there was this kind of change. What I didn't like about it was the way they handled the humanities and social sciences and sciences, the natural sciences, so much so that there was a rethink afterwards. They tried to do it by stealth, diplomas in the evening. That's how some certain courses came. And to be historically correct, okay, because there are a lot of fantasies going around here, certain disciplines which are now taken for granted at university, which were not there then, enter to that diploma. Communications, that's how it started. It did not start after 1987. It started through the diploma courses, ICT, etc. So they introduced communications, ICT. That's how they got introduced. So I did a study on that. One point I did raise, though, with the worker student scheme, it actually did not produce people as being employable, but got them employed. Now, whether he could do that today is a different matter. But at the time, we're talking about the 70s. We're talking about 78 to 1987. That's when the schemes ended, but some of his graduates came out afterwards. They were all guaranteed a job. So this is a point I make. The difference with the neoliberal rhetoric is it does not guarantee you a job. It tells you you are employable. Doesn't mean you're going to be employed. That was not the case at the time. But there were many other things. Okay. Second point was the
university role.
The university role restructuring is we have to be very, very careful about the language and the kind of policies we are taking on board. I think the most basic thing here in Malta is before, with all due respects, because sometimes I'm amazed, with all due respects, is to look at policies critically. You tell me, oh, that's basic. Well, I don't know if it's basic. Maybe because I'm a sociologist, I don't know. But it's sometimes we point to a lot of, because this is what they're doing here. This is the kind of policy. This is what the Lisbon agenda says. But do we look at the ideology which lies behind it? So that is another thing which we have to be very careful. We had a system here where the dominant buzzwords was entrepreneurship. Okay? All the buzzwords were there. That says something. Having said that, I am hopeful, because there are people here, especially from the humanities, who will resist and have a certain power at university. We have to go by individuals now. They have a certain power. They will block those kind of reforms, of course. On the other hand, the humanities cannot remain as they were 30 years ago. So in other words, the humanities also have to be revitalized. The sciences have to be revitalized. The social sciences have to be revitalized. And I think that kind of exercise is taking place. You know, I mean, if I'm doing English literature, yeah, great to learn Chaucer, great to learn Shakespeare, but I should learn other things too. English for different communicative purposes. How to address, to act as a, you know, not in an elitist sense, a public intellectual, writing to a larger audience, etc. So there are so many things that, you know, we cannot ossify anything. Change is always important. But what kind of change? That's the question. Are we going to go back or are we going to move forward? That's my point.
Thanks for your interesting discussion. Towards the conclusion, particularly you specified the point between knowledge being produced for industry on one hand, as we were saying, and knowledge to be produced via a critical means like Habermas to generate the public sphere.
Mm-hmm.
As you're saying, we push forward towards change, but there, I have a slight premonition about whether even when someone generates public democratic spheres, as you were saying rightly, in the communities, as some projects have been noticed in Malta recently, one is also generating a product. But not a product in the sense, maybe in an industrial sense of instrumentalization, with the minimum and maximum type of formula, with the least you get the most.
Mm-hmm.
But a different kind of product. For example, when I discuss with sixth formers art, for me, Picasso's painting is a product in society. Mm-hmm. It generated, not in terms of its value of money, in terms of a product that generates also question. But for me, it is a different product. We should, you should elaborate a little
bit. I would like to. It's actually not just Picasso.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, of course, the more when something becomes, captures imagination, capitalism is always ready to pounce on it. Okay? But I would say, take it at a more popular level. When I look around me, it's very easy to start poo-hooing popular forms of art. I was in a church two days ago because Ronald Sultana's mother died. And I was next to Rafael Vella, and we were looking at some of the, the things which were there, decorations, etc. And I said, people misread Gramsci. I'm going to bring in Gramsci on this. They would probably dismiss this as folklore in a very negative sense. And I said, they don't understand Gramsci if they say that, because I was actually telling Rafael, he wasn't challenging me on it. I said, Gramsci would consider that to be a manifestation. Here's your product. A manifestation of what he calls the popular creative spirit. The popular creative spirit. And that's something which fascinated Gramsci. He talks about societies of the South, very strong on this. He looked at the Neapolitan scene, for instance. The idea is that these will generate new forms of culture. Because they are forms of products, as what you said. Products is the word you use, right? They are products, but outside the sphere of capitalism. Of course, what will happen, of course, is always a tussle, a war of position, he calls it. Because capitalism, through its market experts, all right, and who are doing all kinds of surveys, are on the lookout for these things, and then will try hard to turn it into a commodity with a price to be sold. But there's also the other possibility there, that creative thing, that creative culture, which can also be tutelato, how you say, it could be actually, coached or actually channeled in a different direction, including a political direction. So, any kind of manifestation of culture has to be looked at as a complex phenomenon. It is not, this leads to this. Well, hang on a minute. Yes, but. We have to look at it that way. And I think all societies like that. Most human action is like that. I'm going to say, let's not be an absolutist. Most human action is like that. In terms of the kind of creative kind of I'm talking about, can have different trajectories. Who is going to win the war of position in that respect? So what he's saying is that even left-wing movements, and he was thinking, Gramsci I'm talking about, thinking about this, because after the collapse of the factory council, the factory occupation of the factories, the revolution had failed, and how fascism is working, it's actually how it incorporates these kind of things, or how, rather than incorporates, how it builds on these kind of things, So, yes, product in a broad sense, outside the spheres of capitalist production. There's a lot of productivity. People produce a lot. They don't just produce for factories. they're also producing for other things. But then there are moments when those things also become commercial. A, because the person himself would want to gain a buck out of it. Let's put it this way. Secondly, because people are on the move looking for possibilities. I mean, sorry, I don't want to call one and done, but you can make a lot of associations with this.
Peter, as you know, it takes an army of strategically placed organic intellectuals to reproduce the neoliberal state. Now, in the context of your choice, how would you place academics within this neoliberal state?
Well, academics are a mixed bag, like any kind of worker. They're a mixed bag. Unfortunately, we are, as academics, pressurized into playing that kind of game, even for our own self-promotion. So it's not easy to resist certain things when you're up for a promotion, or more than a promotion. Look at academics outside, all right? We haven't reached a stage yet where they're even trying to safeguard their job, you know? And you get entrapped into this kind of thinking, which becomes an object of survival. Some academics who probably have more power than others can have that choice. I don't say that everybody takes that choice, you know? But I know of academics who spend more time writing in, for example, Truthout, the nation is a bit, it's a bit a bunch of liberals and it's a coterie of people, but they write in these things and they say, no, to hell with my academic papers, I can do that. But that's not easy. In England, a full professor, has to keep publishing in certain areas, again, playing that game, all right? Why? To maintain his program, to maintain the average of the department, so that they would not close that program. So academics are under pressure. Having said that, historically, they have been criticized because in the academic core, all right, of course we have these standout public intellectuals who go against the system. We have our Chomskys, We have people who are not well known in smaller communities. But the majority tend to be more like what Gramsci called the traditional intellectual, who actually thinks he's being neutral or being above politics when he's being political, he or she are being political at the same time. They're mostly men, though. Because more men is to go to get these positions in university. They are part of the system itself. Sometimes also, when we don't recognize, okay, the political partisanship of the position we take in academia, particularly in the humanities, and so I don't know about sciences, but even the sciences, I would assume, when we don't recognize that no knowledge is neutral, then we are also part of the system. And without knowing it, we can become the foot soldiers, the footmen of the neoliberal process. Also, the drive towards making more money out of my knowledge gets me into market research, for example. You know, sociologists, like in Germany, there are many sociologists who work in market research, all this stuff. You know, I mean, why did we reject, for example, going into management? I could have done a doctorate in Carmen in human resource development, because I would not buy that kind of that politics. That is not for me, being in adult education. I could have gone into higher, you know, I would not, that is not my politics, all right? But of course, I do make compromises. I have to earn a living, I've got a family. You know, I'm not a saint in that respect. We all have to put food on the table. But of course, I think it also goes down to the whole idea of not some academics trying to present themselves as being neutral. And when we overdo that, you know, okay, rigor is important, but, you know, trying to be too rigorous, not to be associated with any kind of position, all right? And I think many academics do that. Then you are part of the system. Then you become an instrument as part of the system. And I know, for example, even the people involved with the Frankfurt School had these problems. The problems that, I think it was Habermas. I remember they were telling us in Germany, Habermas, the problems he had with Adorno and others, because he was becoming too political, too openly political, where they wanted to retain that kind of academic rigor. Sometimes, you know, of course, these guys suffered. Of course, they had to leave the country under Nazism. I'm not saying they didn't put their lives on the line. But, you know, we always have these kind of games. But my major problem is not looking at the epistemological politics of what we do. And when we don't see that, we become too mainstream. We take it as if there's some kind of objective truth out there. I've seen this in mainstream economics, for instance. You know, then you are being part of the system. You don't even have to be a firm believer in right-wing politics. Those exist. Okay, but you are, by being claiming to be neutral and objective, you are being part of regeneration of the system. But of course, also many academics are now under tremendous pressure that to survive, they have to do this kind of stuff.
Just a brief comment on what you just said, and then a question. Mm. There's a possibility as well that by articulating these grievances, I'm critics of the neoliberalism policy, the conflict itself becomes encapsulated in an area where it doesn't produce any effect. Mm-hmm. And capitalism can take that in as part of...
It can soak it up.
It can offset it, you know, and write it off as a bad debt, which they can tolerate.
Yeah.
To use a negative sense of toleration. Another thing what I want to talk about is, it's all these conflicts we've seen recently, and others which existed before, Afghanistan, Iraq, etc., before the Arab Spring, the same thing happened. Conflict was always encapsulated. Even we see protests against the G8, protests against debt cancellation, etc., or in favor of debt cancellation, they end up in the same way. There's a choreography which takes place. It gives people the assurance of a degree of autonomy and freedom, which in fact doesn't exist, because it's circumscribed within a space, and the articulation of those grievances are null and void, the effect of that.
I don't know if you agree with me. I feel that way about Egypt. Egypt has been a bit of a letdown. But I want to retain that vestige of hope. I don't know why, but maybe Raymond Williams has influenced me. Always looking for these resources of hope. The way I see it, let's take Egypt, because you have to take a particular case, right? I mean, if you don't change the army, I don't know, you are very well versed on the Arab world, right? That's your subject as well. If you don't change the army, it's a confrontation with the United States at the end of the day. So you can change the leader. But Obama can easily tell, what's his name, Mubarak, right? To move out, so what? But at the end of the day, you have not cut off the head of the king. Because you've got an army which has a strategic, like in Turkey, has a strategic importance in American geopolitics. They can't afford to lose Egypt. That's, by the way, most of the torture takes place, huh? Yeah. So, yeah, yes, it's very easy. I mean, I never used the word Arab Spring, for example, even Linda. We used it in our paper, and then we wanted to change it. And we called the Arab groundswell, not the Arab Spring. Because, it's as good a spring as the Bratislava Spring. Simple as that. Egypt has been a bit of a... Tunisia, I'm not sure. But Egypt, I don't know.
Not just these, because these are obvious. But for instance, like Chomsky in the United States, how has he affected American imperialism? Nothing.
Yes, but then how does a film like Fahrenheit 11, what's his name, the producer, Michael Moore, and etc. Okay, America has this ability to absorb its own critique. And it brags about it. It will tell when you had the Cold War, or when we had the summits. I remember Tom Brokaw, I was living in Canada at the time, studying in Canada, in Edmonton. We had this public service broadcast, it was NBC. Tom Brokaw would tell Gorbachev before a summit in Iceland, I believe it was, he said, but we have the instruments to critique ourselves. At the end of the day, what happens? Nothing. Which is a very good point, and that's how left-wing academics get tolerated. Put them in academia, they are not... No, it's true. I mean, we have some of the most, I've learned most of my stuff, probably more from the United States. Can you believe it? I became radicalized politically, ironically, not in Malta, in the 70s. I had a very superficial, probably still have, but a very superficial knowledge of left-wing politics here. So the first time you have a real good storm, you fall by the wayside, right? Of all places, in an academic department, in one of the most conservative places on earth, Alberta, the province of Alberta, which is an oil-rich area, is famous for its oil. Now, that is the most conservative place in Canada, I can assure you. But you're in academia, you're not living outside, except when you go and buy things, and you've got a few radical professors and friends, and that's it. But that place, who would tell me that a place like that is considered to be redneck? That's the term they use there, all right? Some people would tell me, when I was in Toronto, they would tell me I wouldn't take my body there, okay? And it radicalized me politically. Okay, what do we do? I mean, I don't know, but do ideas have a long-term effect? I don't know. Did Karl Marx change things? Immediately. He was in London, wasn't he? He lived a Victorian life. he left a legacy. I'm not Karl Marx, though. So it would be very pretentious to do that. I don't know. We have to see what these ideas are going to. Well, I'd like to think we can do something in our own small sphere. We'll see. Get involved, you know. Be careful when people ask you to be involved in social change. Who's going to be involved and what is the purpose, etc. You know, we get under pressures at times, now probably more than before. And choose our strategic positions. But I'm not going to talk about myself. I know people who have been doing little things, but very important ones, like infiltrating, etc. I mean, Carmel has been involved a lot in curriculum, and there are other people. So there are other people doing work, and we should highlight that, not to lose a sense of hope. There are some real people. I mean, and if you go internationally, we have these people. They don't appear on CNN. They probably won't even appear on public broadcasting in the United States. You know, they won't appear on television. You might find them, however, in the off-mainstream areas, blogging, which Alex has just researched, right? You might find them in off-the-beaten-track television, Democracy Now!, for instance. These newspapers which go online, you know, you will find them there. Nobody, you know, it's not difficult to get them published in Truthout and Counterpoint. It's not like writing for the New York Times, but if you don't know the right person, you won't get a chance of getting involved. There are these spaces. We have to look for them. But they do exist, and they exist globally, not just locally. I mean, the internet has, with all its problems, has provided one some space. It's not the only space. Anyway, one can go on and on. Alex, which brings me into Alex now. We talk about the internet and blogging, digital literacy.
I think what's interesting is it's like there's a pendulum, no? There's your pendulum of hope. So if you read the book, there's a lot of, I saw a lot of rage and a lot of hope at the same time.
Thank God you saw rage, because somebody said there wasn't rage enough.
No, I saw anger, but there's a lot of humanity, which is your own kind of humanity. But at the same time, the contradictions are, I think, because of the times that we're living in, right? So we have this whole thing about the Arab Spring, then you have people saying this was a joke. It wasn't.
No, yes, it's true.
Okay, you look at the Occupy movements, the indignados, and they a lot of these things have been neutralized at the same time.
It's a bit too early to pass judgment on that.
But my concern is that, and we've talked about the internet, and the same way that the internet can be used to say anything that you want, the internet can also
that works both ways.
Can also be used to, and I think that's the risk that we have even in this country, that you can have a whole alternative discourse which is compartmentalized online, whilst the real business of power is engaged somewhere else. So I want to know how you observe that, also on the basis that, as you said at the beginning, the state hasn't gone away either. Okay, the role of the state. So I just want to know your views. That I think we live in these very strange transitional times, that we have the tools that you can have alternative voices, but you have the institutions which are very permeable. I mean, my brother works in an institution, as you know, in the United Kingdom. He doesn't have a permanent job like a lot of academics have here. He goes from one year to the next. And his
EDRC funding.
His job is first forget the funding so that he can go and do the work that he really wants to do.
Yes. Oh, well,
so,
I mean.
So what are these institutions?
No, what I'm trying to say is that the powers of cooptation and absorption are enormous. They've always been. But, you know, like not facing the possibility of being co-opted is to shy away from the struggle itself. Paulo Freire says that, but there are other people. I mean, it's not going to happen overnight. But I think these little things do have an effect long term. It won't happen overnight. Of course, the power of absorbing, the United States fascinates me, you know, how it absorbs, as you were saying, criticism. Because you get some of the most outrageous criticism. Okay, there are certain boundaries, huh? And Chomsky has always amazed me, Chomsky, how he has survived. Because he goes beyond certain boundaries. Naming names is a different kind of game. But hey, it doesn't have to be the state. It could also be the alternative state, which is terrible. Let's look at Italy. Not far away, all right? Let's look at Italy. It's not the state. I'm not saying there isn't collusion. But there's the alternative state. Try being a critical person in a village in Sicily. You know, they had a conference there on critical pedagogy. It was interesting to see how to become a critical pedagogue in Sicily. All right? And so we know what happened to people who were very strong in the student movement of the 68, who went to Sicily, opened a television station in Ragusa, where it was gunned down by the mafia. Come on, try and be a critical pedagogue in Naples. All right. So you know that there are always limits. It doesn't. In Italy's case, it's also the alternative state, not the northern state. And then what makes it complicated is when that state becomes so powerful, that alternative state, that it becomes part of the mainstream state itself, which has been one of the things about the Sicilian situation. All right? So it is complex, of course. The state is always there. In Italy, they say they don't give a damn about the real state. They say this is, you know, for different, you know, policy more there. But then you have other, there's the link between the alternative state, which is also important. The state is always there, it's powerful. But then I take the Gramscian position, which is basically the state is a site of struggle. The state is also incorporates civil society. And civil society is not simply oppositional. That is not a myth. That is a partial interpretation which came out from certain countries where you had a strong opposition. I would say, for example, civil society in Poland against the Jaruzelski government, or South Africa, ANC versus the state. Then you get that kind of situation as oppositional. As we know, civil society, the way Gramsci uses it, now I'm to my Friday's lecture, the way Gramsci uses it, not civil society as we use it today, it's not just social movements, it's also institutions, is part of the state, but it contains within them the interstices of fighting for change. And this is something I don't think we should lose. People are fighting in spaces, teachers, for example. Now, the problem is how do they get together? This is it, because you could be isolated. And if you're isolated, burnout is likely to be one of the outcomes. But people are getting connected both at the physical level, but more so also at the cyber level as well. I mean, there is a hegemonic globalization, and there is, I don't like to use the word counter-hegemonic, because Gramsci never used it, because I don't set these up as binaries. That's my interpretation of why Gramsci doesn't use it. And there is also globalization from below. Next week, I wish I was there, in Tunisia, we have the World Social Forum. It's going to be from the 26th to the 30th. I wish I was there, actually, during our Holy Week. They're going to be meeting in Tunisia. This is a golden opportunity because it's on our doorstep, so to speak. We never get it another chance like this. And, of course, I have faith in those. Now, let me tell you, I will meet people who become very cynical. You know, oh, those are nothing. You know, that's the way. I don't believe in that. No, I'm sorry. These are pockets. Listen, a system, a political system, started through pockets. Capitalism itself started through pockets. Genoa, etc. These are pockets. You never know in future what's going to happen. We don't know. I can't predict the future. I'm not going to become doctrinaire and say this will lead to this. I would not do that, all right? I'm too Gramscian in this respect to be able to do something like that, okay? That's very positivist as far as I'm concerned. But I do have hope in these movements coming together.
I think one area where you indicate hope has to do with the possibilities for intellectuals and academics. I think you're right not to underestimate the importance of knowledge and information. Just two examples. I mean, the Tariq Ali article about Chavez pointed out the extent to which the Western media just treat him as a clown.
Demonized
that is
him.
To say, they just downgrade his whole economic revolution and the work he's done for the poor. He was not a doctrinaire man.
No,
I was intrigued to find out. There was nothing doctrinaire about Chavez. He was not a believer in ultimate utopian solutions. On the contrary, he was simply trying to shift the balance of power so that poor people had more access to everything. Well, all we get is the usual old story. These policies cause rampant inflation, therefore they are fundamentally inefficient. We're always given that. We need media which tell us, which make accessible to us. One other little example, the Chiapas revolution, the Chiapas occupation. I'm not good at IT, but I found it difficult to get much information on internet about the whole Chiapas
and they fought the internet war.
Development, alternative development process. Yeah, I so I think one should not underestimate, following up on what you've just been saying,
anybody who gets outside
how important information and new positions created in social media are.
Anybody who moves outside the parameters that are constructed as part of the new social order. Now, I don't want to be United States or whatever, but they were the dominant power, right? It's going to be demonized, okay? Some made big mistakes, like maybe Gaddafi. I don't know. Castro has been demonized, for Christ's sake. I have one of my chapters on Cuba. But I'm not interested now. Okay, things did not, maybe did not work. My daughter went there, etc. I hope I will go to Cuba one day. But I'm looking, I try to look at the principles. The principles which are there. And these are found, and by the way, there are also success stories. Huh? What they don't tell us is the WWF considers Cuba as the leading and only nation, leading nation, if not only, which has sustainable development. Now we have all this big talk about sustainability. According to the WWF, Cuba is the one country which has it, you know? Sustainable development. So there are many things. I mean, Carmen went to Cuba. I don't know if there's anybody here who's been to Cuba. I'd love to go, actually. My daughter said, you know, it's not a very good, advert for socialism. That's what my daughter told me. But, you know, like, you look at some of the principles involved in the Cuba Revolution. The whole idea of exchange. Now, okay, we would raise questions in my article there, which I wrote with Antonia Darder, who knows Cuba very well. I mean, she's a Puerto Rican, but she's been there. We raise questions, of course, there are questions. Are you forced to go there? What if I don't want to go? You know, that sort of thing. So there are many things. The whole idea of that you need, you know, that you need special permission to go out of the country and come back. And come back in a particular, at a particular date. Okay? That was a reason for it. They lost 50% of their brain drain. Now, they're beginning to discuss, we raise that question, to remove that. They don't need it anymore. Before, America sucked up all their potential immediately after the revolution. Most of their potential. Okay? I had discussions with Cuban political scientists. We met in Brazil, etc., about this. So what I'm trying to say is that you don't have to be there, but if you meet the right people, you get good insights and information. I'm not going to put something into print if I'm not sure of. I try to, at least.
I mean, this is very interesting because, of course, your thoughts lead to other thoughts. And one of the things about Cuba, which, of course, everybody knows and everybody wonders about, is just how, to use an English expression, how deadbeat the economy is, in the sense that people live a very simple life. There aren't all the consumer goodies. And at one point, I like to make my students, when I'm teaching them about Africa, is that what is rich about Africa is the extent to which they enjoy life and engage in forms of sharing and forms of social relationship on a low material level. And this, of course, raises old, old questions about to what extent do you emphasize the material goodies, which capitalism is so efficient at producing, and to what extent do you look at quality of life, which might even mean a lower material
which means
standard
using
of
a
living.
Car of the 1950s with great mechanics which can make it work so you don't get into the, what they call it, the culture of obsolescence. That's one of the big problems. But Cuba, let me tell you about the economy. Even Raul Castro, and I mentioned this here, it's mentioned here, was on record saying, you know, it's been a disaster. We cannot put always the blame on the blockade. Raul Castro said that. So in other words, there's a lot of thinking. I mean, Cuba's big successes in medicine. And particularly, I just learned this, preventive medicine. In fact, they blamed Chavez of having gone there to cure should have gone to Brazil, they said, because Cuba's famous for its preventive medicine. They're top-notch. Even America recognizes that. One of the few things it does recognize. So when they export doctors, they know what they're exporting. You know, the amount of doctors they have, and they're very good. I mean, even certain research about performance of students in mathematics and languages, it stops. There's been comparative research carried out by Martin Carnoy from Stanford University and others. So you have all this data coming out from the United States itself, critical pedagogues, if you like. Okay? Now, how much of that research moves outside the academic journals? I read it in Comparative Education Review. Well, how many people in the United States are going to read the Comparative Education? It's not the National Enquirer, right? You know? I mean, how are going to read that? But it's amazing, because it shows up Cuba in terms of its academic performance, educational performance, not just universities, in a favorable comparable light to North American westernized countries, when they make comparisons. So there's a lot of success there. Of course, there are problems. Prostitution is back. This was a big fight of the Castro government, you know, the school for prostitutes, etc. Things, you know, there are problems, of course. And of course, you know, if the government is very popular, it must find a way of showing the world that it's got popular acclaim. It doesn't have to be a westernized kind of democratic process. I'm not one of those who say, listen, this is the only good system, the proportional representation. It has been criticized, as we know, in Europe by the indignados to begin with. So, you know, there are good things, but well, we also mentioned the things which jar. I mean, you know, things are not, they're always complex. But there are some really positive principles, and Nicaragua was another one. Now it's gone down to the dogs, eh? Because the Sandinistas sold themselves to the devil. They really sold themselves to remain in power. But you don't have the Cardenas, you know, still there, etc., but the Ortegas. So it's a big sellout by the Sandinistas in that respect. But anyway.
I think one of the interesting areas which you opened up was at the very end, when you went on about the extent to which the neoliberal university or neoliberal educational reforms reduces the public sphere. Now, frankly, I haven't thought much about that. And I think that's a very interesting line which perhaps we can pursue in another seminar. I mean, David Livingston, for example,
is coming in May.
Is coming in May, and he'll be speaking to us upon knowledge and its meaning in today's political economy. So that'll be very interesting. But I think in this seminar series, what we do need to explore is this intriguing possibility that, in fact, the agenda is to reduce the public sphere, is to turn us into individual consumers and producers in whatever kind of academic work we do. One indication of this is Judith Oakley, who has spoken to this seminar, the feminist, she is aware of all kinds of changes going on. And in Cameroonian England, what's happening, apparently, is that in the Ministry of Education, for some time now, there have been ministers who literally are hostile to academics, and the civil servants as well are hostile to academics, which reminds me of some of the things which are beginning to happen here, where you have to fill in all these forms which are handed in to administrators who really don't care, who then file them away, but your time is taken up and you do get worried.
And
so you're under pressure to meet deadlines to fill in
forms.
It's
not just here, eh?
And this is something which has come directly from England, and England in Malta at this university is being accepted as a model at the very time when people in England are trying to take early retirement or get out of England to escape all of these new impositions. So the mechanisms of neoliberal reform, I think, need to be looked at. And
no, it's not just
this England. This would make for fertile talks in the seminar.
It's not just England, because the Bologna process itself, because of the issue of harmonization, so your credits here, I'm just pointing, has to be equivalent to what this guy is doing. You can't actually, you know, work it out to a T. This gives a lot of strength to bureaucracy. So also that contributed. It's not the only thing. Of course, we have a managerial kind of culture, the new managerialism. There's been a book actually edited by Kathleen Lynch and two other persons. I forgot the name, from University College Dublin. I wrote a blurb for it. So it's all about this, the new managerialism in education. And it's affecting our teachers. I mean, it's affecting teachers. Teachers are not allowed. There are teachers and teachers, right? But there are good teachers, come on. Teachers are not allowed to do what they can do best, which is teach. It's all filling in forms, filling in this, the fear of the audits. You get a young headmaster who's just now become a head, so he's afraid of the auditor. So he's going to put pressure on it. It's this whole managerial system that we have here, which is, sometimes, you know, so even discourse about accountability, managerialism, and accountability doesn't mean responsibility. I mean, you have to be responsible. But then there are certain things which, you know, like it's give and take. I mean, what I want from a teacher is a good lesson. I want to see her give a good lesson or him give me a good lesson. I want my kid to learn something. Now, whether she's signed in a form or she has set everything on paper, doesn't mean anything. It's all, everything translates into a figure, performativity, in Lyotard sense of the term.
In fact, I was going to mention the fact that our schools, primary and secondary schools, are being bombarded by this sort of pressure to enter in the EU co-finance projects, and then they get advertised on the newspapers, on the media, get the children interviewed, and you can see, you sort of doubt how much they have learned from this project. Isn't it the same situation? Because before you mentioned the link between the EU and neoliberalism. Uh-huh. Is it the same thing entering our schools? I mean, I would prefer that teachers are able to teach their subjects holistically rather than having a project imposed or just because the head of school accepts the project.
Yeah, one has to look at that. You know, I don't know. I didn't deal with that in the book. And of course, but I work in education, as you know. So one of the things about the projects has also have, I remember my wife writing a letter in the newspaper many years ago to go easy on projects. She felt that projects become an end in themselves rather than a means to an end. So the project has to be valued. I mean, what is a child learning? How does that fit with what they are expected to learn by that age? At the end of the day, it's all about learning. And of course, there are projects which, there's always an abuse of any system. I'm not saying, I will not dismiss those things. I mean, bringing in an international dimension to a person's education is a good thing. All right, the last thing I want is, I'm one of those who promote the idea of the school as a community learning center, but I don't want the community just to be the be-all and end-all. What the Maltese would say, tatsunti darkness, yeah? You know, that kind of, they just campanilismo, they say. So it's important to broaden, the internationalization can also broaden the universe of knowledge. And one has to look at that carefully. At the end of the day, there might also be projects, and I would be surprised if there aren't, which become ends in themselves, and at the end of the day, when you stop and think, say, well, what have you learned out of this? You know, what has been learned? I mean, only the child can actually answer that. X number of years, when she or he looks back with the advantage of hindsight. We do this all the time. You know, we used to dismiss this thing, but we've learned so much from this. But, you know, projects. It's not very different from, like, this week. This week, most of the kids are not in the classroom. They are all doing rehearsals to stage this pageant, all right? At the end of the day, okay, they might get something out of it, but what other things are they missing in the process? So the same applies to international projects, in that sense. But my point is this, that we have now, as part of the system, this kind of, we have a focus on evaluation, but not in the broad sense of the word. Pablo Gentile called it the evaluator state. We evaluate extrinsically, but we also want to create those kind of bodies that you refer to, Maynard, which is basically that I allow myself to be governed. Governmentality, Foucault would call that. That I fit a particular mode of living and of doing things that the government will govern me by proxy, at a distance. That's my understanding of Foucault's notion of governmentality. Excellent. So, you know, that will lead to it. It can lead to it. I don't know. I mean, I don't want to be absolutist and I don't want to be deterministic. There's a lot of this pressure, okay? Certain things have to be done. I mean, we have to be responsible. That's the word I use in many respects. But I think at the end of the day, it's excessive. And it's being protested. It's being protested in many places. It protested in many places. I'd like to see that process also in Malta. We have a lot of bureaucratization coming in. I see this. And a lot of everything has to translate into a number, into a grade. That's performativity in one of the many senses it has, that word, because that word has many senses, the way Lyotard uses it. And, well, basically, it's all regulation, too much regulation. So, I don't know. Somebody would say, we live in a prison. In a prison. A carceral society, Foucault calls it. Edward Bonds calls it, well, a prison is outside, not just inside. He talks that from, I think he takes that from the carceral society of Foucault. That carceral state, I make a lot of reference to it. I love that term. Actually, I went to see Edward Bonds play, Ollie's Prison. And one of the things in that play, there are many, I don't like to reduce a work of art just one thing. I mean, that's how the way I've been taught. Is that, where is the prison? Is it inside or outside? You know, somebody hangs himself in that play because he's going out. First he's celebrating, 2 days I'm going to be out. Then he hangs himself because he realizes he's going to go out. He's going to go out in a larger prison, which will never end. So that says a lot. But the carceral state is something that I like to use even for Malta. Because we have manifestations of the carceral state. Now, the United States is a classic example of that, and Giroux draws on that. It's a militaristic culture. You know, it's all about based on torture. He's got his famous books, Hearts of Darkness, playing on Conrad's title, how Egypt comes into it, how they send them, you know, America will never create the torture in America. They send them to other places, Egypt being one of them, et cetera, et cetera. How many people who are in a dead-end situation, like the poor, who are often either native or black, indigenous or black, they end up sucked into militarization, come back in body bags, etc., etc. Not only that, the poverty is also induced by the war in Iraq, because the debt which is created is then made up for by cutting down on social programs. There are people who have been on a waiting list for a transplant, and all of a sudden they cut this. The governor of I don't know what cuts it down. Now you tell me that's a death sentence. Okay, Henri Giroux writes a lot about this and mentions this. So that's Henri Giroux's position. I learned from him about the United States. But I'm interested in Malta, not the United States. And the Madrid, well, I'm interested in all over the world. I'm interested in humanity. The classic example of the carceral state for me here in Malta is migrants. The way migrants are treated. The open centers or closed centers are manifestations of the carceral state. And what the point I make in one of the chapters there on migration is I use that metaphor also to deal with how the southern European countries who are being overwhelmed, although we have to look at the facts and statistics properly, have their own manifestations of the carceral state through the detention centers. They're not the only ones, but they are the most visible. And, you know, when we look at Safi and all these places, and people are almost in cages, you know, if that is not a carceral state, then I don't know what is. And the best work I think I can think of, call it ethnographic if you will, it's a journalistic piece of work, is Bilal. You know the book, Bilal by Fabrizio Gatti, Italian journalist who played a part, I don't know what his features are like, but he played a part of an African migrant left with them from someplace in Africa, Sudan, I think, actually traveled the whole way and ended up in a centro di accoglienza permanente, temporanea, that's what they call them, that's the euphemism, in Italy, the island, Lampedusa, and he came up in the espresso with a huge indictment. And then you had Pisano, the leader of the police, trying to denounce this. And then he published a book called Bilal was his name, the name he took on. It was, you know, a very well-known Muslim name, Bilal. And it's a book, which you'll find it I bought it from one of the outlets in Fiumicino Airport, something like that. And the indictment of the carceral state. The carceral state, and of course in the United States, remember even schools are manifestations, public schools I'm talking about. I'm talking public, not in the English sense. Public schools, what are security guards doing in schools? Come on. Everywhere. Security guards. A person gets beaten up because he hasn't got his shirt tucked in, and he's disabled, and he's beaten up. This is the United States. This is what happens if you can't afford to send your child to a private school. If you want the inner cities. That's Henri Giroux's notion of the carceral state. I bring in the issue of migration in that context. I'm sure there are other manifestations we can come up with. I think it's a very powerful metaphor, the notion of carceral society, carceral state. And now you've got Edward Bond, who comes out with this play, you know, juxtaposing the two areas, which I thought was quite interesting. And in Malta, we had a short story came out now. There's a book of short stories which I just reviewed, of Lilian Shiberas. And she has it's called The Substitute. There are elements of it there as well. It's about an asylum.
When you answered Carmel, Peter, you talked about a crisis of mission of the university.
Crisis of mission?
Yeah, of the university. And that the role of the academia, the role of the academic must change.
Mm-hmm.
It must change because today, the university is still a sanctuary of knowledge. And in the neoliberal game, this knowledge is sold to the consumer.
Hmm.
And, yeah. the academic is part of this game.
Oh, yeah.
What can happen, in your opinion, in 5-10 years' time, when all this knowledge that's lying around in cyberspace is no longer guarded by the academic, is no longer bound within the library.
The fuse. Well, I don't know. I can't gaze into a crystal ball. I'd like to think is, first of all, in any educational enterprise, I'm using that word as well. In any kind of educational endeavor, it's not how you it's what you are. All right? Don Milani will say, come devi essere per poter far scuola, how you are. So at the end of the day, it's up to the academic himself or herself to question herself and say, listen, What's my purpose here? I can try and answer that by to personally. As you know, I used to, for many years, confine my writing, not in the past, because I started off in journalism, with a small j, of course. I was awful, in fact. In fact, I burned all of my writings because the English was horrible, and I thought I was a bit presumptuous when I was young. Okay, probably still am, but I was very presumptuous when I was young. I used to write about everything. Now, what I'm trying to do now, personally, is that I want to reach out to a larger audience. So I never miss an opportunity to share ideas with different groups of students, academics, etc. So that's my traveling. But on the other hand, I also try as much as possible to give my service for free to communities. I try. I'm no saint, but I try. And the other thing I started exploring recently, he's been bugging me about this, different media. Something I didn't do before. I used to write in academic journals, that kind of language. Then you ask yourself, who's going to read this paper? Probably 3 or 4 people at the end of the day. But you got your promotion, you got your kudos, you got everything. So I started writing in Truthout. That was Henry Giroux got me writing in Truthout. He was the one who asked me. I became like a drug. So then I started writing. I liked the idea, getting hits and getting responses. Then, of course, I even tried writing, can you believe it, in the local papers. I used to hate writing in local papers, not out of an elitist sense. I felt I was never, with all due respects, thanks to his brother probably, I got in. I felt they would always, I always felt that my piece of work would be distorted somehow. I've had experiences like this. Things even cut out. For example, I'll just give you an example. I didn't like this. I wrote a review of an art book edited by Rafel, Cross Currents, you are in it. And I had a dig, but I felt a particular piece of work was, let me put it this way, insipid. I didn't use that word. But I said, this is straight from out of the Monty Python textbook. It was a laughing person like this. It was a picture. I was thinking of Life of Brian. Would you believe it? They published my work, didn't tell me, and that line was left out. And I didn't like that. And I said, well, to hell with newspapers here in Malta. I'm not going to publish in newspapers. On the other hand, if I'm going to get an idea across publicly, this is the way, it can get across. So people still stop me and say, listen, what about the second idea of a second university? Why? Because I wrote a paper on that. So they stop me about this. What about the idea of a participatory budget? These were all ideas which I would love to see take it up to the campaign. So I put them out in a newspaper. So what do we have to do? We have to look at different publics. We have to look at different publics. I think the notion of, let's use intellectual with a small I. We do intellectual work in a Gramscian sense, right? But even somebody, a shop steward, is doing intellectual work. Huh? It's not just us. So we're not the only intellectual workers around. That's one thing we have to get straight. Every society had its intellectuals, irrespective of whether it had a university or academy or not. That's something I keep telling students. But we are just amongst these intellectuals. So there are many intellectuals out there, all right? Now, let's try to break boundaries and use different kinds of spaces. You're probably much more well-versed than I am, because you're into blogging and things. I'm not very much of a blogger myself. But I'm a plodder, perhaps, not a blogger. But the point is that's what we have to do as academics. We have to move the boundaries, I'd love to see the university have a project, I told this to the rector once, where we outreach, we go into communities, use public, the public, what do you call them, the local councils have some beautiful premises in certain places. Why not? And we've done it, we've often done it when we've been invited. But it would be great to have some kind of program of this type. I'm a bit hopeful about the Scotonera project. Unlike others, I still believe in it. I can take on board, of course, who are we to go and tell the Scotonera people what to do? Somebody has written about this. I think it depends. If you're open to listening and to learning from people, I think we can provide a service there, of course. But of course, we have to also provide the people with skills that they want, which connect them with the mainstream, because at the end of the day, they don't want their dens over there. They want to connect to the mainstream. So there are certain things which we can provide. There are some other things that we can do together. It has to be two ways. So breaking boundaries. Of course, your traditional academic will be very loath to do that kind of stuff. Of course. Another thing is that we're doing this in English here, right? And there are people who are not are English speaking. When I teach, when I make this very clear, when I teach my students here in school, at university, and they're all Maltese, I often use Maltese when I explain, irrespective of what the Senate decides about this, because I find it's much more engaging. I find the debates are not just on a cerebral, but also on an emotional level, etc. John Ngugi writes about this. I do that. Sometimes the students themselves say, we prefer English. That's my hegemony, Gramsci hegemony students, talking about hegemony, how ironic. You know, they want the hegemony of English to be continued, you know? So, you know, but many times, especially those who know me, when I used to teach, when I teach student teachers, I often teach in Maltese if I don't have Erasmus students around, okay? Erasmus students are also important, because they bring in new ideas, it's great. And then on my PhD course, I have to teach in English. I've got one Austrian, and there are only about five. It's a small group, this one. It's like a tutorial. I've got an Austrian, and I've got two Irish persons, and I have to say, you know, their presence is also important, because we can compare ideas from different countries. Some not that dissimilar to ours. Two Catholic countries, remember, with all the Catholic culture, which connect with our education system, Ireland and Austria. Anyway, well, what can an academic do? I mean, we can write a whole book about that. I don't know, everybody's got his own ideas, his or her. And I'm probably tired right now. Everybody's tired.
Right, Peter, thank you very, very much for an impressively wide-ranging discussion. Bringing in such a wide range of ideas, situations, and literature. I'm sure we've all been stimulated. And I think one of the most strong indications of just how important your talk is that it's led to so many different questions. In an interesting way, it looks to me like your book, The Politics of Indignation, maps out a really wide open agenda of all kinds of areas where discussions like the one that has taken place tonight need to take place. And so perhaps in this seminar series, Work in Progress in the Social Studies, what we ought to be doing is getting a few more speakers to zero in on particular aspects of public space, public activity, and compare them with this underlying drive towards individualization and privatization, which is affecting us all. So, Peter, thank you very, very much for tonight's
Thank you. Thanks for coming.